Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we present a story by California author Anna Scotti, an award-winning poet whose work has appeared in The New Yorker and a variety of literary journals, and who's recently seen the publication of a collection of her poems entitled Bewildered by All This Broken Sky. Also a novelist and short story writer, she received the Patterson Prize for her young adult novel Big and Bad. The series from which the story you are about to listen to was chosen features a protagonist who's in witness protection, a character whose name and job change from story to story as she's moved for her own protection. There have already been 5 stories in this series published in EQMM, and there's another coming up later this year. Here is Anna Scotti reading her story, What the Morning Never Suspected, the second in the series from the September-October 2020 issue of EQMM.
There's a kind of woman in Southern California, a woman of a certain age, I think they were called at one time, as if every person isn't. Anyway, I've met movie stars in New York and beach betties in Florida, but this kind of woman you'll find only in Beverly Hills and the upscale suburbs of Los Angeles, the beach cities and foothill towns. It takes money, I guess, to pay for the Pilates and to have time for yoga, but this SoCal woman doesn't flaunt it. She's not wearing kabuki-style makeup or the latest fashion from Milan. Her hair is natural, or at least it looks that way. If she spends money on cosmetics, it's for really good night cream. Beth Keller was one of those. Slim but not skinny, with a smooth knot of tawny hair pulled back from a face nearly bare of makeup. She wore loose jeans that didn't hide the firm curve of her hips, and a pale blue chambray shirt, sleeves rolled up to show narrow wrists with that bump of carpal bone that somehow only the most attractive women seem to have. Her hands were smooth and lightly tanned, nails short and clean, no nonsense. She could have been 30, but for the soft skin at her throat and the fine etching of lines around her eyes and bracketing her mouth. I was guessing 50, but her real age might have been 5 years north or south of that. No matter. Beth Keller was a good-looking woman. I amended that as her agate-green eyes met my own. Beth Keller was a knockout. 2 dogs, big greyhounds from the look of them, swarmed around her legs, nuzzling her and casting me doleful glances. "Cam," she said, taking my hand in her own. I wasn't used to my new name yet. I'd been Audrey for 3 months until I'd moved from the West Side, and Serena for 3 years before that. There were still bad guys looking for red-headed Juliet in Billings, Montana, and for ombre blonde Serena in Tallahassee. My birth name is a lot less exotic than any of those. I could tell it to you, but then I'd have to kill you. Kidding. Sort of. Thank you for driving all the way out here, Beth continued. I know it's a hassle, this close to rush hour. I suppressed a grin. Rush hour in the Palisades, where Beth's cottage was perched on a low shelf of rock, the ocean tumbling just feet away, starts at 2:30 in the afternoon and lasts until 7, 8 on a Friday, when the Beverly Hills crowds head toward their Malibu homes for the weekend. It was no trouble, Mrs. Keller, I assured her. I needed the job. My last gig, working as an aide in an old folks' home, had gone sour when a new resident, a retired professor of dead languages, had seemed to recognize me during his occasional forays out of the fog. Witness protection had been kind enough to allow me to stay in state with the stipulation that I change my name, apartment, job, and hair color. Now I was bunking on a smelly sofa in the pool house of a Santa Monica restaurateur. Thank you, Airbnb. It was not my Barbie dream house, but it was cheap and seemed reasonably safe and private. Call me Beth, please, Cam. She leaned down to scratch the bigger hound behind the ears. I hope you like dogs. This is Vindy, and his sister is Meme. They're not really brother and sister, of course. They're both racetrack retirees. She glanced at me, and I crouched to let Meme sniff my face and jacket. The dogs made me uneasy, but I wasn't sure why. They seemed docile enough, and I've always liked animals. You'll be, I don't know what your job title will be exactly, what they called a gal Friday when I was first out of college, Mrs. Keller said. Personal assistant, I guess, she concluded finally. I've got a terribly busy schedule right now. I'm on the board of a charity, and my daughter's planning her wedding and her dissertation defense. She stopped. That's a thing they do when you're trying to get a PhD, she said uncertainly. I nodded and tried to look blank. I'd never get to defend my own doctoral dissertation, but I'd defended a thesis in library science like it was a rosy-lipped virgin and I was a Victorian mama. It wouldn't do to let that slip, though. I went to a couple of years of college, I offered, general studies. Beth nodded. I knew you were educated, she said generously. You speak well. I smiled, thinking of Viola's words to Olivia in Twelfth Night. Alas, I took great pains to study it, and 'tis poetical. My master's degree, and a bachelor's in English literature, were more or less going to waste. There were not many jobs available in Witprotec for wannabe librarians. Anyway, I've got a lot on my plate, Beth continued. And if you've got a reliable car and insurance, and you're willing to put in some long hours, and sometimes, I'm afraid, some boring ones, I'd love to have you. In fact, my daughter's bridesmaids are getting together tonight to go over logistics, and the housekeeper's off. I could really use your help right now. We settled on a rate that seemed generous after the minimum wage I'd received at the nursing home. I put out my hand, and Beth looked surprised for just a moment. Then she shook it firmly, and an hour later, I was picking through organic avocados at Whole Foods and thinking, this might be the easiest gig of my life. After unpacking the party supplies, there's a local ordinance that says you can't throw a shindig west of Sepulveda without serving guacamole. I sat at Beth's dining room table for an hour, paying bills the old-fashioned way, with a checkbook and pen. I stamped each envelope and put the checks aside for her signature. Then, as she'd gone out without leaving me enough to do, I set to work straightening the living room. It wasn't a mess, but she told me the housekeeper had Thursdays off, and the scattered papers and odd coffee cups weren't going to tidy themselves. Big French doors at the western end of the long room opened up onto the gorgeous steel-gray sea, and I stood at the balcony rail for a moment, breathing deeply in time to the crash and rush of the waves just feet beneath me. Beth's sofas were low-slung and modern, typical upscale beach stuff, with a huge, incomprehensible oil painting, a smash of crimson and purple and orange, with what looked like strips of candy dot paper glued asymmetrically to the center, hung on the southern wall, providing most of the color in the room. The northern wall was all shelves. There were more photos than books. Beth with a young Eurasian woman who had to be her daughter, a very young Beth with two swaddled infants at her breast, a man's arm protectively around them all, Beth with a pair of black-haired toddlers, and then a boy and girl, 10 or 12 at most. A few of just the kids, together or separately, and one of the daughter alone, wearing cap, gown, and a big old smile. At some point, the man, a good-looking, rugged type, Asian, with Clark Kent glasses that mocked the firm square of his jaw, dropped out of the photos. That wasn't unusual. Divorce is a rite of passage in Southern California. Everybody over 30 has at least one under his or her belt. But where had the boy gone? Most of the books were junk. Paperback beach reads stacked haphazardly by size here, color there. She had some Carolyn C., though, and everything ever written by Maxine Hong Kingston and Amy Tan, and a couple of well-thumbed volumes of Twain, Hawthorne, and Steinbeck that looked like a signed reading someone had actually read. On one shelf, taking pride of place, was a rather ugly, foot-tall steel sculpture on a lucite base. It seemed to represent some sort of elongated bird with upstretched wings. The plaque read, Beth Keller, Angel's Face, 2010 honoree, in recognition of 10 years of selfless service. Every cloud is an angel's face. So, angel, not bird. I racked my brain for the quote, Tennyson? Browning? I looked at the ocean and cleared my mind, librarian's trick, and it hit me. Lydia Marie Child, crusader for all who were oppressed, meaning just about everyone in her 19th century world. Hello? Beth came in through the garage, jangling keys. She saw the trophy in my hands and colored appealingly. Embarrassing, she said. And they're giving me another one this year. It's my organization. I'm the founder. But does anyone listen to me? I begged them to pick someone else. Is it a beauty thing? I asked her. Angel's face? Beth laughed and pushed her hair back self-consciously. Hardly. Angel's face provides assistance to those who have lost a loved one, often a child, to drunk driving. Or, she added somberly, careless driving, texting, speeding. She shook her head. There's an app, can you believe it? An app that kids use to record themselves speeding. It's crazy. There was a case in Florida. Two kids were going 115 miles per hour, and they slammed into a van and killed a family, and themselves, too. Beth's limpid eyes were shadowed as she spoke, the lines bracketing her mouth deeper than they'd seemed earlier. Sorry, I said. I didn't mean to snoop. I was just straightening up a little since I finished the bills. Thanks, Beth said absently. Hey, Maria isn't coming, and I didn't hire any servers for tonight. It's just the girls and me. Would you mind helping me in the kitchen? I'm here to serve, I said with a mock bow, and Beth rewarded me with a quick, musical laugh. Beth's daughter, Melina, was a very different type from her mother. She was mid-twenties, slim, with fine bones and lots of curves, but the resemblance ended there. Melina wore her glossy hair, nearly black, cropped short and ragged, a black silk mandarin jacket, clearly tailored to hug her curves, was buttoned primly at her neck. A purple raw silk pencil skirt and faux combat boots completed her outfit, and this was not a gal who eschewed makeup. It was when Melina met my eyes that I saw the resemblance. Hers, too, were utterly lovely, deep jade green fringed in black. Thanks for helping out my mom, Melina told me, introducing me to her gal pals. They were a mixed bag, a couple of party girl blondes probably left over from college, a faux nerdy Asian girl in glasses and white Oxford shirt, an older African-American woman I pegged as Melina's faculty advisor, and, surprise, a skinny 20-something boy wearing eyeliner and lipstick Melina introduced as her maid of honor. When everyone had drinks and crudités, Beth invited me to sit, but I declined, wanting to tidy the kitchen before I hit PCH. It wasn't too bad. Beth was a clean-as-you-cook type, and I got it spick and span within 20 minutes. She'd left a bottle of Pinot Grigio on ice, and I brought it into the living room, offering it around. The Asian girl and one of the blondes waved me away. DDs, Beth explained, designated drivers. I noticed that her own glass was empty and filled it. Being on the Angel's Face board doesn't necessarily make you a prude, Beth said, smiling, but Melina must have caught my glance toward her chaste green bottle of Evian. I hate alcohol, she said flatly. It ruins a lot of lives. I want the wedding to be boozeless. Honey, the gay boy said cheerfully, knocking back his own drink. No stoli, no wedding. At least not with me by your side. Melina softened and put her arm around his neck, pulling him close. She kissed the top of his head, and he grinned. I love you, Mikey, she told him. I would not get married without you. In fact, if Greg runs out on me, you're in line to be my groom. Mike grinned. I set the nearly empty bottle on the coffee table and said my goodnights. But Melina's harsh stance had me wondering. Maybe therein lay the clue to the missing men of the family. And indeed, not 3 days later, I was sorting papers as Maria walked the dogs down on the beach when Beth came into the room holding two gowns up high to keep them from trailing. Oh, the emerald, I told her without waiting to be asked. Please, the emerald. She was getting ready for an Angel's Face fundraiser in Century City. The arrangements were mostly in place, but she'd kept me busy phoning guests for last-minute RSVPs and nagging the florist and the valet service about details. Beth flushed and set the pale blue gown on the sofa. She held the green silk against her t-shirt and jeans with one hand and tried to push her hair up off her neck with the other. "Well," she said, laughing, "you get the idea. I'd normally go for black, but they specifically want color for the photos." I nodded. "They're both gorge, but the green matches your eyes. Do you have a necklace?" "Pearls, I think," Beth said. "I could go for something more contemporary, but Alan, my husband, he liked me in pearls." She must have sensed the curiosity I tried to mask. "Alan died 11 years ago, just after our son. Denny was hit by a car. Drunk driver, of course. Alan was with him, but wasn't hurt." She let her hair go and turned away, shaking wrinkles from the emerald silk. "Not hurt in the body, at least. He jumped off the roof of the Kenner building a year later, to the day." "I'm sorry," I said lamely, taking the dress from her. I picked up the blue crepe de chine. "It's why I do this," Beth said, turning back to me. Her eyes were dry. "I founded Angel's Face in Denny's memory. It was the only thing I could think of, to try to make something positive from his life. You can't imagine how hard it is. I don't mean the loss. Anyone who's ever loved someone can imagine that. But all the details, the police, the insurance, the hospitals, the funeral arrangements, calling everyone, the school, the hockey coach." Her laugh was hoarse and painful. "Thank you notes for the flowers, you know? So many details. And then therapy if you need it, help with the bills. Angel's Face tries to make it a little easier on the families who've lost someone to a drunk driver or a careless driver, with advice, with funds, with childcare, whatever they need." She picked up the photo of herself with her children, the one where they looked to be on the verge of adolescence. Denny was 13, looked just like his dad, but with a sunnier personality. He was always joking. He used to get in trouble. Beth shook her head and put the photograph down. "Sorry, I'm a bore." I didn't answer. There was nothing to say. I carried the dresses into Beth's bedroom and laid them on the bed for Maria to tend to when she got back with the dogs. I chalk it up to my inquisitive nature as a former librarian, and not to morbid curiosity, that I was on a search engine later that night, a dish of Kalamata olives and a glass of Pinot Noir at the ready. The Times reported it pretty much as Beth had said. Alan Tanaka had fallen or jumped from the roof of a downtown office building a year to the day after his son had been struck and killed by a businessman heading home from an overindulgent lunch. The photo they'd run on the front page of the local section showed a handsome guy with a clean grin and a mischievous quirk to his eyebrow. No Clark Kent glasses this time. Nice blue shirt, spiffy tie. I guessed the photo had been taken before the accident. I touched his pixelated face. "Grief fills the room up of my absent child," I whispered. "Lies in his bed, walks up and down with me." Those were Arthur's mother's grief-stricken words, not his father's in King John. But Alan's plummet to earth was proof that a father's grief is just as deep. There was no picture of Bob Innes, the guy who'd apparently never been told that the three-martini lunch was a thing of the past. I wondered what that would be like, to kill a kid and ruin another life in the bargain. Had Innes ever enjoyed another drink? Had he kept his job and his family? Had he gone to jail? But NexusLexus revealed that the correct box to check was none of the above. Innes himself had died just a few months after the accident, ironically also in a traffic accident, this one a hit and run. I sighed. He who lives by the sword and all that. I thought of Melina's cold words. I pushed my wine aside and got up to make a cup of tea. I wasn't invited to the Angel's Face dinner in Beth's honor, but I was there anyway in an unofficial capacity and on the payroll. I wasn't quite sure what Beth wanted my function to be, but she didn't have a date, and for $25 an hour I was happy to drive Beth's Range Rover to the event, handle the valet parking, and hold her purse while she was on stage, just as stunning as I'd imagined, in the emerald silk and pearls. She'd opted to let her golden brown hair fall down around her shoulders, and her lips were stained a vivid carmine. Frost's observation came to mind. The afternoon knows what the morning never suspected. What if Alan Tanaka could have seen his wife in this moment? 300 pairs of eyes on her undeniably beautiful face, radiant with pride. Alan and Beth could have been growing old together, doing the work of Angel's Face together, looking forward to Melina's marriage, and, someday, grandchildren. Instead, he'd chosen oblivion. Melina herself had selected black slacks and a white linen top, makeup uncharacteristically light. Her hair was combed back close to her head. She sat in the seat next to her mother's, listening attentively as Beth spoke. When Beth rejoined her table, I didn't mind sitting in the hall, reading the Times on my phone while I waited for the interminable cycle of speeches and applause, to come to an end. It was a bit annoying when Beth appeared, flushed and sparkly, at the very end of the event and told me she was going to take the Range Rover to an after-party and that I should go home in an Uber. Melina, who'd brought her own car, had already left, so there was no ride-catching to be had. "I'm sorry, Cam," she murmured, taking the keys and the valet card I offered, perhaps slightly reluctantly. My car was still at her place in the Palisades, and this was turning into a hassle. "Just go on home," Beth instructed, "if you can do without your car for the rest of the night. Uber back to the house in the morning, and I'll reimburse you for both rides, of course." By the time Uber driver Abu texted that he was at the valet island in a little Kia Rio, most of the guests had cleared out, and the valets were beginning to gather. I was surprised to see Beth's Range Rover just pulling up. She pressed a bill into the valet's hand, her nails scarlet against his brown skin. I waggled my hand in greeting, but Beth turned away, letting the tawny curtain of her hair fall around her shoulders as she got into the big car, either not seeing me or pretending not to. The valet got one last ogle of her ample cleavage and slammed the door. I shrugged. There seemed to be little point in being overly sensitive at 2 a.m. Abu had me nearly home to Chef Jason's pool house when my best instincts overcame exhaustion. I don't like to be without wheels. Maybe that comes from having crept out of more than one short-term rental in the middle of the night. Abu flipped a Yui happily. It's probably tough to get a fare late on a weeknight. 20 minutes later, I was in Beth's driveway. From inside the dark house, Meme or Vindy barked once, low and threatening, as I fumbled for my keys. You'd think in a town the size of L.A., one murder would make barely a ripple, but that depends entirely upon who's getting popped. Think Nicole Simpson, Billionaire Boys Club, or for that matter, Lana Clarkson. Don't remember Lana? Maybe not. But you do remember the headlines when Phil Spector was convicted of her murder. Kids and old folks can die anonymously by the dozens in Compton or East L.A., but knock off an attractive blonde or a well-heeled businessman on the West Side, and you're going to make headlines. Mari Gruber's death was going to be one of those. It was clear from the chipper faces of the local morning news team. They were grinning and yipping like a yard full of puppies with a greasy bone. Fairly well-known guy, wealthy, owned car dealerships in the valley and a semi-hip gastropub in West L.A. Somebody had slipped into his stylish West Hollywood bungalow and slid a knife between his ribs, then disappeared again into the balmy night. The details of the murder were not available yet, but Gruber's bio was an interesting bit of cultural history. Born to a tailor and a homemaker, dropped out at 16 to make music, realized there was more money in selling cars, built a string of dealerships and a concomitant small fortune, and married and divorced a few times along the way. No kids, or at least none acknowledged. He'd made the papers 7 or 8 years back when he'd driven his Porsche into the front window of a Santa Monica sports bar. 6 or 7 patrons were injured, a waitress killed, and the club owner bankrupted in the inevitable lawsuits. Apparently the poor guy should have anticipated that a Xanax-addled driver might jump the curb and smash into his front window, but had neglected to erect crash barriers. Once, in my first life as a librarian and PhD candidate, I came across a French proverb that has stayed with me. My French is a shameful thing. I leave pronunciation to braver souls. But it goes something along the lines of, "It's more disgraceful to be suspicious of your friends than it is to be deceived by them." I try to live with that thought in mind, but the truth is, I've been deceived by friends. I've been flimflammed by my boss and stabbed by a soulmate. So, end of the day, I just don't like coincidences. Google didn't turn up anything, but later the next afternoon, I was back on duty at Beth's, using my phone to research gifts for a wedding party. I DM'd Melina a couple of bridal accounts to follow, but my best find so far was a satin floral robe on Etsy, really pretty and sure to please any red-blooded woman, not to mention her man. I thought Melina's man of honor, Mike, would like it too, but my heart wasn't in it. I needed to know, but didn't really want to know, if Mari Gruber's car crash victims had been clients of Angel's Face. Beth was out, but I didn't want Maria to catch me snooping around her laptop. I clicked on a link to engraved cufflinks. Does anyone actually wear cufflinks anymore? Meme came into the room, looked around suspiciously, and came to where I sat, sighing deeply as she lay down and put her head on my foot. I scratched her head absently and tried Bonanza.com. When Maria leashed the dogs up at 2, I slipped into Beth's office and took a quick look through the desk drawers. There wasn't much there, no paper files, other than a few appliance manuals. I moved to Beth's bedroom and grabbed her MacBook Pro off the dock and sat. It wasn't hard to find the list of Angel Face clients. The group had helped a lot of people in 15 years. Widows, siblings, bereaved parents, a teenager who'd been permanently disabled when his motor scooter argued with a pickup truck, was going to college in style, in a van with a wheelchair ramp and hand controls. I'll bet he felt lucky. The waitress who died in the sports bar crash had left behind 3 kids, each now in possession of a fat scholarship, and one receiving extra dough for weekly therapy. I wondered if it would help those kids to know that the man who killed their mom was dead now, too. How could it? Why would it? I launched Beth's FaceTime app. There were only a couple of contacts to scroll through, and Melina answered right away. "Hey, Mom," she began, then stopped abruptly. "Hi, Melina," I said brightly. "I thought I'd show you some of these cool goodies I found for the wedding." I plucked a candle from Beth's bedside table and held it up to the screen. "How about this?" "Cute," Melina said absently, touching her hair. "Hey, Cam, I'm kind of busy right now. Could we do this later?" She was a little choppy over the Wi-Fi, but I could see well enough to notice her beautifully sculpted scarlet nails, so different from her mother's utilitarian manicure. I heard Maria come in with the dogs. She got busy in the kitchen banging pots and pans as she put together supper. Vindy didn't seem to like me the way Meme did. He nosed the bedroom door open and came in, staring at me mournfully, until I invited him over for a head scratch. That was how Beth found us an hour later. I won't say I'd been crying, but I won't say I hadn't either. A dog's rough coat is good for keeping secrets. I didn't know Beth well, but I liked her a lot. I'm not even sure I liked her less knowing what she'd done, the special services she'd provided to the victims of reckless drivers, apparently without their knowledge or approval. "What's wrong? Are you ill, Cam?" Beth said, brows knitted together in concern. She laid her cool hand on my forehead. As I'd remembered, her nails were short and buffed clear. "I think I know why you did it, Beth," I said. "I get it. I guess you see yourself as a force for good, righting wrongs and all that. But you know, Mari Gruber might have had friends who will miss him. If his businesses close down, his employees will lose their jobs. That first guy, at least I think he was probably your first, Bob Innes, he had children, too. He had a wife. Do you think they miss him? Do you think his kids were better off growing up without a dad?" Beth stared at me, her lovely green eyes narrowed. I could see that she knew she shouldn't speak, but she was impelled by her loathing. They were better off growing up without that dad, she said bitterly. Maybe he would have killed them, too.
Maybe, I agreed. Or maybe he would have done anything to right the wrong he committed. Maybe he would have spent his entire life doing good works and making the world better. Maybe he would have taken his kids to baseball games and to the theater and gone to their parent-teacher conferences and...
Oh, shut up, Cam, Beth said finally. You don't know anything about it. Drunks are drunks. They don't change. And there's nothing Bob Innes could have done to right the wrong. He killed Denny. He murdered my son.
And you became a murderer too, I said, and turned your daughter into a murderer. Beth shook her head. She sat down beside me on the edge of the bed and began to pet Vindy, who whined softly.
Never, she said. Melina is not a murderer.
She gave you an alibi so you could do the dirty work, I said flatly. It must feel nice to know you can fit into the same dress as your hot 25-year-old daughter. The wig is a masterpiece. Melina really had me fooled at the valet station, though I wondered why she wouldn't look at me.
Beth shook her head. Melina didn't do anything.
She's still guilty, Beth, I said. I don't see how you can argue that she didn't know what you were going to do. Why else would she put on your gown and makeup and take your car, if not to provide you with an alibi? The valet certainly noticed her. The neckline on that gown and a nice fat tip guaranteed that. What did she do? Go to a bar where she'd be sure to be noticed? Beautiful woman in an emerald gown?
Beth shook her head. A Denny's, she said. The bars were already closed.
She hesitated.
When you're a mother, Cam, you'll understand. For now, just go away. Just forget about me and Melina. I'll pay you. I'll pay you for a month. I'll pay you anything.
Poor Greg, I said absently. I'd never even gotten to meet the bridegroom. One thing I had learned about crime from my unwilling encounters with it is that it's always the innocent who pay the highest price.
Poor Mike. He won't get to be a maid of honor after all. Poor greyhounds. Do you think your housekeeper will take them? Do you think she'll find another job?
Beth's eyes filled with tears, and Vindy whined again. I think I knew from the beginning, I told her. On some level, I wish I had walked out the door the day I met you and your dogs. Beth looked puzzled, then smiled. Her teeth were white and clean, real L.A. teeth. She truly was a beautiful woman.
Meme and Vindy, I said softly. Vindy looked up when he heard his name.
Memento and Vindicto.
Memory and revenge.
I cursed my librarian's memory. It all made sense.
Unfortunately, it all made sense.
What the Morning Never Suspected is copyrighted by Anna Scotti. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at ellerycreenmysterymagazine.com.